Hey everybody, it's Justin here, your host at Embodied. We know that there's been a lot going on in the last couple days, to say the least, and we don't want you to think that we're not paying attention, that we're not watching. We are. We're actually working on some things right now as we speak to hopefully address some of the events of the last couple of days, and so we will get those to you as soon as they are ready. But for now, we do have an episode that was recorded before these events, and we think that it will be helpful for processing this the last couple of days, even though it doesn't directly mention them. So we will be releasing some episodes like that, and we will let you know when we have the episodes that will more directly address what's happened in the past couple days. What's going on? This is Justin, your host here at Embodied. This week on the pod, we're really excited to welcome Dr. Rico Manje. Rico is an assistant professor of theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego. He writes about Islam, Christianity, Hinduism. We get into a lot of stuff. We talk about the religious right. We talk about skepticism. We talk about growing up in evangelical Christianity and kind of how he kind of navigated those spaces, both growing up and as an adult. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting conversation. Definitely for the nerds out there, the theology nerds, religion nerds out there, this would be especially interesting, but I think it's actually interesting for everyone who is interested about spirituality and religion and theology. So yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. Rico was my high school English teacher, so there's a little bit of a bias that I have towards him. But yeah, it's a great conversation, and we look forward to bringing you more of Rico in the future. If you want to join our Facebook group, go to facebook.com/groups/embodiedcast. That's facebook.com/groups/embodiedcast. That's how you can find us on there. And then on Twitter, we are at embodiedcast. That's our handle. Both of those are great ways to get in touch with us. If you have a question that you want to send us privately, you can email us at embodiedcast@gmail.com. And we can hopefully get to that question either via email or even on the show potentially. So yeah, join the Facebook group. That's the best way to stay up to date with what we're doing. We may be doing some live events coming up in the near future that you have to be a part of the group to be able to access. So that would be a good reason to get involved there. So yeah, so without further ado, let's talk to Rico. Right, Majay, what's going on, man? Welcome to the hallway.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me, Justin.
So tell us about you. Who is Rico Manje? How do you identify across the identity spectrum of race, of gender, sexuality, religion, et cetera, et cetera?
I identify as Chicano, as Mexican American, but with a very kind of interesting background there. Similar to what a lot of Californians have, which is I come from a family that immigrated in the early 20th century. This particular family, my parents and grandparents, felt a strong pressure to assimilate. So they didn't pass down speaking Spanish as a first language or second language. And yet I kind of grew up growing up in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area, particularly Whittier. It was kind of just normal to be a fairly white Mexican American. So I wasn't visible, in any particular way. when I say that, like, visible, I mean that in the sense of how people who feel marginalized or are marginalized, ethnic minorities constantly feel visible.
Right.
So I look back and I see three kind of definitive moments in my life that made me a bit more aware of that background. Maybe it's more like four, but one early one, actually before I left California, was I got involved in the punk rock movement, punk rock scene. And that's something we should come back to on the, because it's also one of the most formative moments in my spiritual development as well. But as far as like identifying as Chicano, you know, the punk rock scene is quite interesting for all sorts of activism, sometimes very contradictory activism. So you have a home for neo-Nazis and white supremacists on the one hand, and then on the other hand, a home for anarcho-socialist lefty radicals and so forth, and right, then right. Almost anything in between. So and watching clashes between those two happen on a regular basis was eye-opening.
Like, and like physical altercations or
physical altercations, yes, and even just curious situations where, like, I had a shaved head back then, just as part of the punk rock scene, and like some of my friends who were also Chicano, but were darker skinned than I was. You know, there's one time we were at a Denny's and some white supremacist skinheads come in, and I can see they're eyeballing me as like, what are you doing with them? Right, and there's this kind of weird moment at which I realize that, like, I show up as visible, but in this in between.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, where like they felt I should be
with them,
and not with the people that I actually shared an ethnic commonality with in this regard. And so we ended up having to get out of there pretty quick, because we could sense that there was trouble brewing, and we kind of made a backdoor exit before they could corner us. But in another situation, you know, I used to go to several shows where the main singer would kind of call out any neo-Nazis in the crowd and say, like, look, you're not welcome at these concerts if you're here, blah, blah, blah. And then he would even taunt them with the statement of, a bunch of you are just self-loathing half-Mexicans anyway.
And I'm sure that went over excellently.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely trying to provoke. And fights would break out. Like, the guy in question got hospitalized multiple times. But he seemed to be fine with forcing the issue. You know,
continuing.
Getting people to see, let the true colors come out. But when I moved to New York, I'm working on a master's degree in New York. I regularly would get, so your name's Rico, are you Cuban, right? I'd be like, no, I'm Mexican. Like, no, you mean Puerto Rican? Like, no, I'm Mexican. And then inevitably something would come along like, oh, so you're like one of those Mexicans. I can remember for the first time, like, you know, living in LA, that was just like, that would have never been a category, but
right.
There was this attitude of like, first I was just like, what is that supposed to mean? But then I also kind of like knew what it was supposed to mean, you know, like,
yeah. What did it mean?
I mean, for me, it means like upper, like middle class and upper class Latinos and educated Latinos on the East Coast. For a lot of people, in a place even as cosmopolitan as New York, were Cubans and Puerto Ricans. Mexicans were still busboys and car wash attendants, and you know, that was really what kind of showed up. And it was like, oh, so then one of those mates is like, was like somebody that's you know, whiteified or broken out of it. You know, like there was this kind of...
You made it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that whole, like, I made it out of the hood narrative.
Yeah.
That you find in hip hop so often, you know.
Right. Right.
Well, maybe a little bit different because there's... Yeah.
Well, it's definitely different because in my case, I... Not at all my experience, you know.
Right.
I grew up in a very middle class LA home, you know. But the expectation on the East Coast was, oh, well, if you're both identify as Mexican and you're doing this, yes, it fits in with that narrative you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And there I had this moment where, and it paralleled a previous moment, where I'm walking through Brooklyn to get a gift for a family member, you know, looking for an actual Brooklyn Dodgers cap in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Which you can't find, interestingly enough. But
there's plenty of them here, so.
Yeah. But as I'm walking around there, I realize I've encountered something that in California, by and large, doesn't exist. So here's the reverse, which is an utterly... completely, thoroughly middle class black neighborhood.
Hmm.
And so in California, I'm kind of like programmed from my upbringing that like if it's predominantly, you know, that usually means lower income or mm-hmm, this or that. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't. So in other words, what was eye-opening to me about it was there was no sense of feeling... even like a pre-programmed kind of societal unsafe, you know?
Right.
It was, I'm just really visible.
Hmm. As a brown person.
I look different
than
everybody else here.
Yeah.
Right. And I'd had a similar experience in a college group where I went to a college group and everyone was a Christian college group and everyone was Asian.
Hmm.
And a similar thing of like, whoa, like,
yeah.
I just feel visible in a way I'd never... And both of those times, it brought it home to me how that's what a lot of people have to deal with every frickin' day of their life.
Yeah. That hyper-visibility.
That hyper-visibility is just like, that's every day.
Yeah, yeah.
What I was getting in those little brief moments was the everyday existence of other people. And, yeah. And it really opened up potential for empathy and seeing things more deeply in how, and just getting that kind of flipped experience, right? Just as a side note, it was one of those areas where Karl Marx's philosophy, I think, gets... doesn't get enough credit for how sophisticated it is beyond just economics and so forth.
Right.
Marx will say flat out that it's that ideas come from practical life.
Hmm.
Practical life experience. Like, so just having an idea or an activist type idea is not really going to be sufficient for social change. You actually have to have the conditions of life change, and that leads to idea change later, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But for him, that even means like actual, what he calls the sensuousness of life or interpersonal relations. So in other words, you can learn all you want in the classroom, right? And that's good. Nothing wrong. I'm a teacher. I'm a professor. Like
Same.
Right? Right. But in the classroom, you can't make those experiences happen.
The one that you had walking through Brooklyn.
Brooklyn or at the Christian group or, right. You know, like those have to be lived, you know, they have to be. And then also like, so like recently I was showing my students this, but, you know, Killer Mike or Michael Render, the hip hop artist, he was talking about Ferguson. And one of the things he's talked about there is like what people ask him, well, what can we do? The CNN Inc. What can we do? And part of it, he had a number of really helpful solutions, I think. But one of them, just on the interpersonal level, is like make friends with someone outside of your culture, of your economics, you know, strat out that looks different than you. Like, and what I was conveying to the students is what he's actually articulating there is something that, as I read him, Marx would approve of. It's like, you actually need, that changes you. And that then changes your ideas and changes your activity. And so, but until you actually have those relational changes, your sense of identity and other people's identity in relation to you, I think this is quite limited.
So what do you do when your maybe formational tradition or your formational worldview is one that is predicated on not changing your views, you know, because that's kind of at the heart, the philosophical thrust of conservatism, you know, whether it's religiously or politically, it's about, you know, avoiding change, you know, it's about holding on to things as they are. And so, you know, I don't know. So, you know, just a bit of, you know, for those listening, Rico was my high school English teacher. A million years ago, we won't say how long, but you know, I went to and you worked at a conservative evangelical Christian school. So I'm wondering,
what role does all of this play?
Yes. Thank you.
That's a great transition point, even to another aspect of this, right? Where you know, identify as Chicano, and that sense of Chicanoness, as I was just explaining, has grown over time. And also I was born into a Roman Catholic family that converted to evangelicals, which in that conversion process of moving from Roman Catholic to evangelical Christian, you can kind of get a very hostile towards what you're converting away from, right? So I was raised with a rather strong anti-Roman Catholic sensibility.
How did they come to have that transition? What led to that?
So my dad had been very nominally Catholic. He's born into it, and my mom had become an evangelical when I was probably in kindergarten, and then a couple of years later he followed suit, and then eventually, the whole little enclave of my very large extended Mexican family became evangelical. So my uncles, my grandmother and grandfather. But the countless, seemingly countless brothers and sisters of my grandmother and grandfather, they almost all of their families remain Roman Catholic. So I grew up watching a lot of just painful battles over funerals and what type of funeral should be granted and so forth. That goes right along with what you're saying, where it's like, has to be this way or no other way, right?
Right.
It's already been figured out. And, you know, if we don't give them the Catholic funeral, the person's going to, you know, have a harder time getting through. Or if on the flip side, oh, it's this terrible, you know, Catholic funerals are terrible superstition, and if we do that, then it doesn't really truly honor them or honor God, you know. And as a young person into my teens, watching this, this was a difficult thing to like sort out, to realize like there seemed like really good people on both sides of this, and yet it's so important to them that it go one way or the other.
Yeah,
you know?
To be right.
And so, you know, for me in college, you know, like I said, I went to the same high school where I taught you, right?
Oh, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so
that's
I was an
funny.
Alumnus there. So so I have a double experience.
Yeah,
on that.
Double consciousness.
Yeah. And so I grew up, you know, the science classes, the Bible classes, you know, all the stuff that says, man, here it is. It's all figured out.
Was it more conservative when you went there than when I went there? Or was it about the same, would you say?
I would say it was probably slightly more conservative when I went there. I can't recall anyone teaching in the science departments then who openly accepted evolutionary theory, for example.
Right.
Whereas by the time I was teaching there, there was at least one or two teachers in the science department. And there was even, if I recall correctly, there was a point counterpoint in the school newspaper between a young earth creationist and an evolutionary science adherent. So that I think wouldn't have happened when I was a student there. But you know, the overall idea that, you know, creationism is really the, if you're a good Christian, that's what you'll believe.
That's it.
That's it. It's figured out. Boom.
Boom. God said it. Yeah. I believe it. That does it.
Yeah. The Bible says it this way. It must be a literal science or historical textbook. And therefore, we'll do a backwards math to prove it.
Right.
Yeah. And so I get to college and...
Wait, can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when you were in high school, were you all in... Or were you a skeptic, or what was your, and growing up as an evangelical, like what was your kind of, I know you're seeing all these things, but were you kind of like in it, like, you know, in it to win it, youth group, playing the guitar, the whole thing, or were you a skeptic? Because I see you now as a skeptic. So that's why I'm like, that's why I'm curious to see if you've always just kind of always had that sense of skepticism, or if, you know, it's something that came with time for you.
It's interesting you say that, because and we'll get to this later, I'm sure, but I very much, the philosopher Paul Ricoeur, I very much identify with his a lot of his approach to religion and theology. But one of the things that he's most known for is having labeled Marx, Freud, and Nietzsche as the masters of suspicion. And Ricoeur sees himself as a Christian who is also in the tradition of the masters of suspicion. So that is, you're quite right to pick up that's where I kind of locate, where it's like, I very much still identify as Christian, but with a very, very Marxist, Nietzschean, Freudian sensibility that is always looking for what's really going on here.
Right.
What's really at stake behind these words or this sermon or this.
Right. You know? What ideologies are.
Yeah. You know, yeah. What's really at play. So
you're putting on the glasses that show you the messages on the billboards. Very Zizekian.
Yeah. Yes, 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 yes. Zizek's another one of my faves, but, when I was younger, I was all in, man. I was, in high school, for the first half of high school, I was like young Republicans, you know, Nixon Library is like where I like to hang out.
So much fun, dude. Just listen to those tapes on loop, you know, Watergate tapes on loop. That's, you know. That's it. That's a whole day right there.
And honestly, I think more socialized that way, even by the student culture at Whittier Christian at the time, than by even the teachers, because there was kind of this dominant, like, if you're going to be like cool, you've got to be down with like this certain take on conservatism, you know, or you're just some either, you know, you're just not very smart. I mean, you know, like if you want to be like the smart and also like accepted kid, you know.
Right.
And so like one of my friends back then, you know, she was the only Democrat in the whole school, at least willing to say she was. You know, we used to give her all kinds of crap about it. But anyhow, so but my junior year of high school, towards the end of it, I actually had what I'll just label for the sake of this interview an existential crisis, which everything was kind of thrown into question for me. And I kind of got really obsessed with trying to see if any of this stuff actually could hold true. And I stumbled across a book by Hugh Ross. So he was a Christian evolutionist, where he just like destroys a lot of creation science type stuff. And at that point, I started arguing a lot with, I think, who we probably both had for physics and whatnot.
So did this start the existential crisis, or did you find this book?
I found it because of the existential crisis. Okay. So the existential crisis was kind of like self-caused. I mean,
16
years old, yeah. Biochemical changes. I don't know how else to explain it. But
it wasn't like some event happened.
No.
It was just kind of like...
No, it was really actually... I mean, I can remember the moment, but it was a mundane moment. Right. Where I'm just kind of sitting there, and suddenly the world just like... It was like, you know, I'd taken the red pill and the Matrix, and nothing was going to be the same. But so I discovered this, and that made me quite questioning. I get to college, and I keep... So senior year, I was becoming more of a skeptic. College.
Where'd you go to college?
So I went to Harvey Mudd for my first year at the Claremont Colleges, and then transferred to Pomona. So my whole undergrad was at the Claremont Colleges.
Yeah.
And, there was just a point at which I was just like, look, evolution is a thing. It happened. Like, you know. Like,
we got to deal with it.
Yeah. And I remember going to one of my pastors at the time. I was in Calvary Chapel at this point in my life. That's mainly what I was raised in. And they gave me an encyclopedia of Bible difficulties, like to kind of hang on to this, you know, inerrancy idea. And it was actually the thing that made me give up on biblical inerrancy, because reading it, I was like, this is so far-fetched.
So can you talk a little bit about Calvary Chapel for those listening who don't know what the connotations are? But then I do want to get back to the inerrancy and your journey with some of these core... tenets of evangelical Christian fundamentalism, you know, the fundamentals as they are called.
Yes. Which is the history of that term even is quite interesting.
Yeah. That's my Biola coming out. Yeah.
So, refresh me again on where you wanted me to go. Calvary Chapel. Yes.
Yeah. So just give it, like, if you could paint a picture for those listening who are like,
yeah, especially if you're not from California.
Yeah, or if you're not even from evangelicalism, like what would that mean? What would that look like? Like, paint a picture of.
Yeah, yeah. You know. So Calvary Chapel grew out of what was called like the Jesus People movement in the 1960s, which were kind of like a bunch of surfer / hippie types that decided that they wanted to be Jesus freaks, and that term kind of comes from that era too. And they really wanted this more low-key type of Christianity. The Vineyard Church grew out of the same movement, as well as a few other groups that neither the Vineyard or Calvary Chapel likes to talk about. And we can probably leave them out of this discussion as well. But
which ones are not?
I mean, there's like, you can look it up, but like... Joaquin Phoenix and his family, they were involved in what most people would call a cult, that was like a splinter from the same group. And they were quite radical, shall we say. They had a lot more of the hippie sexual ethic going on. But yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas Calvary Chapel and Vineyard had much, very traditional Christian morality.
They just wore Hawaiian shirts.
Yes, they just wore Hawaiian shirts. You could have a mullet, you know, those kinds of things where...
They surfed.
They surfed.
Yeah.
And they used guitars. And, you know, a lot of these things that Calvary Chapel and Vineyard pioneered are now standard at non-denominational evangelical churches. So
it's kind of like what we think of when we, you know, culturally think of evangelicalism. It's like they kind of pioneered the model.
Yeah, yeah, that whole thing of like a stage with a rock band on it that plays a worship set really was pioneered by the Calvary Chapel and Vineyard movement, and then kind of spread into the Baptist circles and other, just all the many non-denominational evangelical churches. The other thing about Calvary Chapel that's really interesting is that they try to claim that they're a very non-dogmatic church, so they don't have like a lot of official doctrines. In fact, it's like a list of maybe, I think the list is like four things long, right? That said, there's plenty of unofficial stuff.
Lots of opinions.
Yes. And then there's also the reality that one of the four things that they hold to as absolutely you must believe is that there's going to be a pre-tribulational rapture prior to a literal 7-year tribulation, prior to the, you know, a literal return of Christ and the millennial reign and all this. And so they're
very specific.
It's a very specific thing to plant your flag on. And it has all sorts of theological implications, and not theological, but like political, ecological implications that are not healthy, in my view. It's been shown, like, from the Reagan administration on, that with a lot of people and the dominance of the religious right espousing a lot of these ideas, you know, if you firmly believe the world's going to end in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years tops, and that all the Christians are going to be whisked away before all hell breaks loose, there's not a lot of reason to care about global warming. There's not a lot of reason to care about present civil rights issues. This is all going to get scrapped anyway, and Jesus is going to fix it. And that really doesn't mesh with the message that I find in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which plays a role in my transitioning out of that world. But, you know, in general, through college, I came to find that what the evangelical fundamentalism I got both in my schooling and also that I got through the Calvary Chapel background, just it was intellectually untenable.
So what was that like to realize that? In terms of, like, both for you and then for you and your family?
You know, in some ways, it took me way longer to realize it than it should, just because comfort zones can leave you in a holding pattern.
Right.
And if you don't want to rock the boat, you just kind of keep doing stuff, you know. And
you keep going to the church.
Yeah. So I found myself still going to church, but I would just sit there reading the Bible, like, during the whole service, because I felt like I was getting nothing out of the sermon. I'd get more out of just reading on my own. But I also was just kind of in this place of paralysis where I had so many doubts that it made it hard for me to act one way or the other. And it wasn't until then another kind of big turning point where there's a major, a long-term relationship I had that fell apart and it arguably through my own kind of spiritual apathy, I guess, you can put it in those terms here. And it made me come to myself and say, look, you know, one of the philosophers that stood out to you in your undergrad education that really spoke to you was Soren Kierkegaard. His idea of a leap of faith, that you're never going to reason your way out of doubts and that sort of thing. Like, either do this or don't do this. But stop torturing yourself with this intermediary kind of doing it and kind of doubting it. You know, go all in, give it one last go, or give up on it, basically, was where I came to as a result of this self-reevaluation, second existential crisis as a result of this breakup. And it was at that point that I started reading a lot of books on spiritual disciplines. Dallas Willard, Richard Foster, and these kinds of figures. And from there, I found Eastern Orthodox spirituality. And I found that Eastern Orthodox spirituality was kind of offering everything that I felt that Foster and Willard and that spiritual formation crowd was offering, but with a long history of, 2,000 years of practice and so forth built up around it. Now we can also, as we, I'm sure we'll talk more about that, I have plenty of skeptical and critical things to say about my own traditions.
So. Yeah, yeah. That's, yeah, I mean, that's not surprising to me. And so do you think your family, I mean, I don't like talking about family.
Oh, yeah,
time,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like, it.
Now that I've said all this, I'll be able to get back to that. So yeah, 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 go ahead.
But like, you know, what was your family's response having come from Roman Catholicism? And which is, you know, would you say it's like a sister tradition to Eastern Orthodoxy, or closer to Eastern Orthodoxy than Evangelical Christianity in terms of the rituals and the rites? And
yeah, yeah. So for people who don't know, generally speaking, I mean, Rome will tell the story one way, the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox will tell it another way. But the most objective way of looking at it is that they all had their bishops and governance structures, and they had separate languages, Latin and Greek, as right, the dominant languages. And the two traditions just kind of slowly grew apart, both politically, spiritually, theologically, linguistically, geographically. And they really kind of broke into two halves at that point. And then Protestantism then is formed solely in its descendancy and reaction and protest to the Roman Catholic Church. So
right, long after, or not,
yeah,
long?
A good 500 years after, yeah, that split. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a complex issue because some of the concerns of the reformers, and even some of the more radical reformers like the Anabaptists and the Quakers and so forth, they actually resonate quite heavily with Eastern Orthodox spirituality. But it is also the case that as far as the sacraments, the rituals, the liturgy, all that kind of stuff, certainly much closer to the Catholic Church. And as far as the mystical traditions within the Catholic Church, figures like St. Bonaventure, St. John of the Cross, St. Teresa of Avila, Nicholas of Cusa. These figures are people within Roman Catholicism that easily you could say, oh, that they sound like Eastern Orthodox theologians.
Yeah. Right, right.
So, yeah, but my family, it was tough because, it was a mixed bag, you know, like, they didn't know what to do entirely about it because it is this kind of other category that leaves people kind of scratching their head as to like, what is this? And then they keep thinking like they know what it is and that they can attack it. And then they get frustrated when they feel like the ground keeps shifting on them. Because in other words, they feel like they're attacking Catholicism, but then it'll be this weird, like, well, not entirely. And so then, but people tend to be unsettled in general. It's human nature to be unsettled when someone you care about and whose education you respect kind of decides, you know what, I'm not gonna do this anymore, I'm gonna do this instead. It makes everyone question, like, should I be doing that too? Do I need to double down on what I'm still doing, you know?
Right.
So it led to a lot of those kind of questions, some really tense moments, but not nearly as bad as you know, some family, you know. In the end, it was largely supportive and just a few heated conversations,
yeah,
more or less.
If you could say something to someone going through that now, what would you kind of tell maybe a younger version of yourself?
Younger version of me, you know, the main thing I would tell a younger version of me is that to really never let go of the mystical wonder inherent in Orthodox spirituality that comes back to what you're asking about at the beginning of. For me, that mystical wonder is the path in any sort of spiritual path of to break out of the idea that there are any sort of once and for all answers, that like there it is, there's nothing more to ponder, to think about, to contemplate, to grow in union with, just done, right? To keep that in mind in all of your conversations with people, and not turn into just another type of fundamentalist who's now like, no, this is all wrong, what I'm doing is all right. And yeah, that would be the biggest caution. Be like, hey, younger me, you're going to learn that the vast majority of Orthodox don't even know about this side of the theology and spirituality you love so deeply. So maybe shouldn't be so hard on other Christian traditions.
Yeah. So you leave this evangelical Christian high school. You go to New York to pursue a seminary degree.
Yes, at an Orthodox seminary.
At an Orthodox seminary. And so in that moment, were you thinking, this is it? This is my trajectory. This is what I'm going to be doing. Or were you thinking, oh, I'm going to keep going. I want to do something different. I want to, you know, be a professor at a Jesuit school, you know?
So, yeah. So I was originally, I mean, prior to the existential crisis that led to my becoming Orthodox, I was set up to do a PhD in English Lit, and I abandoned it to go, do more spiritual exploration with an MDiv. And so when I settled on Orthodoxy, I decided to go to the main Orthodox seminary in the Western Hemisphere, which is New York, St. Vladimir's Orthodox Seminary. In that move, I had decided that getting a PhD was something to fulfill my own ego. And I was all in with, I'm going to become, you know, me and my wife, we were moving out there with the idea that I'm going to become a priest. And that's the career trajectory that I had. And it wasn't until about midway through there that I had multiple professors and even some fellow students that said, look, you have really rare academic abilities. Not everybody needs to go straight into the priesthood. You might, you know, we can use more thinkers out there in academia that have this kind of spirituality as their grounding. And so I kind of took that as a nudging to like maybe take back up the PhD, but in a new direction. Instead of English Lit, I did religious studies. So, and that's how I ended up at UC Santa Barbara after that. So that was, we didn't think we were going to stay. I mean, we thought when we went to seminary, I was just going to end up a priest somewhere at the other side, and it actually turned out radically differently. So that's part of why I am ordained, but I'm at the level of the deacon, which is just below a priest. Bishop, priest, deacon are, you know, ancient orders in both the Catholic and Orthodox churches, and Anglican as well. I've kind of stayed there, happy at that spot, for now. But academia, I mean, in front of the classroom, I really feel like, you know, this is, I mean, we all have our down days, but when I'm on in the classroom, I feel like this is what I was born to do, you know?
Yeah, I totally get that. Yeah. And so now sitting here, you know, 2016, how would you describe your spiritual self?
Do you add like a more specific dimension to that, maybe?
Yeah. So, how do you see your own spirituality playing itself out in the world, both with yourself and maybe with others? And, you know,
in my teaching vocation.
Yeah. As well, or can you even say like your politics or anything like that, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that got worked out very heavily for me during my PhD program is engaging very deeply with these masters of suspicion, as I put them, the Karl Marxes, the Sigmund Freuds, and especially Friedrich Nietzsche, who became the kind of backbone of my dissertation. And those three deconstructing a lot of what, even in my becoming Orthodox, I realized I still held dear or still was looking for in religion. So in other words, some sort of coherence to be granted to the world that is grounding in bedrock and fairly, yeah. you feel fairly certain about. And also the function of theodicy, or the idea that, you know, resolving the problem of evil, that often what you want out of religion is a security blanket that tells you evil has a purpose and it'll all be okay.
Yeah. In the end.
Okay. In the end. And Freud, Marx, and Nietzsche, all in very different ways, are pretty scathing about that function. Right. So Marx, of course, that function sees it as the opiate of the people. Freud sees it as something that, you know, unlike Marx, Freud thinks we all need something to alleviate the pain. that is just
an
inherent.
An opiate isn't bad.
Yeah. In existence. But for Freud, religion, you know, is kind of an infantilized way of dealing with it, and that you need to just grow up and understand that life sucks, and functional unhappiness as opposed to dysfunctional unhappiness is what you want to aim for. But also for him, like, religion imposes one way on everybody at dealing with the pain, which in some cases actually makes the pain worse, or Freud's psychotherapy gives multiple paths, right?
Right.
And then with Nietzsche, I found that I was very taken by his argument that relying on that kind of notion of that everything is going to be okay in the next life is a way of disparaging this life. Is it actually a form of hatred at this life? That hatred, and also towards other people, right? And he'll go through, and even Thomas Aquinas and others, Tertullian and others, he'll point out how there's this, like, glee that one is in heaven while also taking satisfaction at others being punished forever.
Yeah, the hell, yeah.
And so Nietzsche was like, how is that not a religion of hate? Sounds like a lot more like a religion of hate than of love.
Right.
And so that's part of that Masters of Suspicion thing of looking at it as like, well, it calls itself love, but if I peel back the layers, it sure seems to look more like hate. And these things all caused me to refine or dig deeper into my Orthodox spirituality to see, is there something that stands up, like, still through all these criticisms? Or maybe even as I put it in one of my articles, a transformative engagement with these criticisms. And one, you know, a kind of broad takeaway that I have from all of these is that I agree with a lot of contemporary thinkers that theodicy, trying to justify evil, is not what religion or spirituality or belief or faith or whatever you want to call it ought to be doing. In other words, religion as a palliative, religion as a way to hibernate or feel better about things, I have no time for that anymore.
Is that what you would identify the religion of your youth being about?
I think so, yeah. I think it definitely had. And that's where that conservatism you're talking about comes in, right? Is inherent in something like theodicy, inherent in justifying evil, is a conservatism that says the way things are is acceptable. Or even further, the way things are is how they are ought to be.
Or even the way things used to be is what we should go back to.
Right. And you see this even outside of Christendom. You see this in India right now where there's, you know, they're not that recent, but the elections of just a year or two ago show this kind of move towards away from secular society to doubling down on a kind of Hindu fundamentalism, which often, again, like, you know, Hinduism has its own forms of theodicy that you know, especially in the karma samsara way of approaching existence and the caste system. You know, there's a very strong sense of, like, yeah, it's actually utterly legitimate that
inequality exists.
Inequality exists.
Yeah.
And while Christianity has a much, you know, had a much stronger, you know, with passages like from Paul and Galatians, there's neither, you know, Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, Christianity still has a long history of not actually pondering the depths of what that might mean.
Or even just like proclaiming it and, to be true in the midst of inequality as a means to not do anything about it.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? So like
it becomes like
conceptual. Why are we talking about this? Because there's neither, you know, Jew nor Greek, blah, 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 you know, as opposed to, no, that's maybe an ideal, but that's not our social reality.
That right there, yet just it brings me back to one of my favorite Nietzsche quotes. Of course, when I say that, there's about 200 of those. But
yeah,
there's a part where he's criticizing Plato and Greek philosophy, and he praises Thucydides, on the other hand, for his approach to history. And he says that Plato is a coward in the face of the real. So Thucydides, because he reports history as it is like heroic and brave for Nietzsche.
Mm.
And even has a certain like self-mastery in that. Whereas he says Plato is a coward in the face of the real. Consequently, he flees to the ideal.
Hmm.
It goes right with what you're saying, where it's like the real inequalities are out there, but we can all know that in God's eyes, we're equal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And right. We all know, I mean, this is used and, you know, like you think of even like a recent film, you know, based on history, like 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
There's the horrible people that, like, you know, utterly horrible people like Michael Fassbender portrayed.
Right. Right?
But someone like Benedict Cumberbatch, mm-hmm. his character, mm-hmm. was a very, you know, apparently devout Christian and just couldn't kind of handle what he was involved in.
Right.
And kind of wanted to, like, bury his head in the sand to it.
Swept along by the tide of the culture. Yeah. And, you know, what have you. Yeah.
He's got that same sort of thing where it's like, well, he can affirm on the ideal the dignity of the humanity of each of his slaves, while in reality not giving it to them.
Right. by the fact that he has slaves.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And like he sells them to other people.
Right. In the Chelsea Handler documentary that just came out on Netflix, mm-hmm. on racism, it's called On Racism. There's a part where she's talking to some Confederate soldier reenactors, or, you know, and they were talking about why did the Civil War happen, et cetera, et cetera. But one of them starts saying, you know, if I paid a ton of money for a tractor, I would take good care of it. So therefore, you have to understand that masters took very good care of their slaves. And so we watched this in my class when we were talking about it, and I was like, what's going on there? What's the implicit argument? And one of my students said, the assumption is that it's okay to own people like you own machinery, you know? That's not okay. Like, that assumption, that ability to kind of be okay with that, you know, is fundamentally not okay. And so it makes me wonder what kinds of ideas, even politically, do we kind of assent to that in 150, 200 years, people will look back and be like, how did they in one breath say this and in the other breath either not do anything about it or, you know, actively participate in this, you know?
And that actually, you know, to tie some of these threads together too, Dostoevsky, it was another key element of my research and dissertation and teaching. And, you know, Ivan Karamazov's bit in the Brothers Karamazov attacking theodicy, attacking why is there so much suffering in the world. And attacking in particular Leibniz's Best of All Possible Worlds, but also Augustine and Aquinas's free will arguments and so forth. But what he's basically, all the various Christian theodicies rely off of the idea that in the end, it'll all be okay. in the end, this is all working towards a higher harmony. In the end, there's some greater purpose for this all. And what Ivan rightly notes, I think, there is, if that's what I'm assenting to, then I am complicit in the torture and murder of these children that I think are necessary for God as architect to build this higher harmony in the future. Like, it actually legitimizes it or even valorizes it as good. And as I was talking to my students, I said, to understand fully what he's saying, because it's hard for us, we don't think of heaven and hell and these kind of afterlife promises that way. We think of them as like, oh no, that like sets things right. But it's like, if you follow the logic like Ivan does, saying you have to say all these things had to happen in order for us to get to that best end result, which means it's good that they happened on some level. In other words, if you believe America and contemporary, maybe not America a long time ago, but contemporary America is awesome and it needed to come into existence. We also have to deal with, it was built economically on the backs of slavery, and it was built geographically and economically through genocide of the Native Americans and the seizure of their land. So in stating that, like, America as it is now needed to happen, you've actually said implicitly that the genocide of the Native Americans and slavery were, while bad, necessary for the final good outcome.
So yeah, we just want to thank you again for listening to the pod and supporting us. If you want to join us on Facebook, again, that's facebook.com/groups/embodiedcast. Great way to get involved. Twitter @embodiedcast, our email embodiedcast@gmail.com. Leave us a review on iTunes, drop us a comment on SoundCloud. Those are great ways to give us feedback. So yeah, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Embodied is produced by Justin Campbell with production assistance from Carlos Antonio Delgado, Jason Jenkins, Delisa Perry, and Philip Yaw Dumfey. So until next time, peace.